Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Announced plans to cut up to 30,000 jobs and close 14 plants from St. Louis to Ontario over the next 6 years. Ford announced the massive cuts today at its Dearborn, Michigan headquarters, just hours after posting a 19% gain in fourth quarter earnings over last year. The company CEO, Bill Ford, said the company is responding to slumping SUV sales in the wake of high gas prices, but said Ford would try to help communities affected by the cuts.
These cuts are a painful last resort, and I'm deeply mindful of their impact. They're going to affect many lives, many families, and many communities, and we'll do everything we reasonably can to ease the burdens.
Micheline Maynard of the New York Times was at that Ford press conference today. She joins us now on the line with more. And Mickey, plants are closing across North America, but what are the hardest hit areas?
Well, the hardest hit areas will be the Detroit area, where a big luxury car plant is closing in Wixom. Ford is also closing a plant in St. Louis and another one in Atlanta, and it will close a couple of parts plants, a transmission plant outside of Cleveland, and then up in Canada, it's closing one assembly line in its plant in St. Thomas, Ontario.
The Ford CEO and others up to this press conference have talked about some of the reasons for the slumping sales, including, as we said, disinterest in the SUV in light of high gas prices. But there's also health benefits, and the United Auto Workers of America recently agreed to health care cuts for union members. How did they respond to today's announcement? And does Ford need them to sign off on it, or is it a fait accompli?
Well, the UAW president, Ron Gettelfinger, even before this announcement, said that he'd try to change Ford's mind. He said that they have worked in the past to reverse announcements like this, and they hope to this time. One thing to remember is that Ford can idle plants under the UAW contract, but they can't be permanently closed until after the contract expires in 2007. So these workers will be paid, even if their plant shuts down, and there are always very generous packages negotiated at the end of the contract to take care of these workers.
And obviously, I'm sure, even if they have pay for another year, these workers are going to be devastated.
Well, these are the kinds of jobs that don't exist in America anymore. People are making the equivalent of about $27 an hour just in wages. And then when you add in benefits like pensions and health care, the average cost to the auto companies goes up to $67 an hour. So you do not get this kind of a job working at a non-union plant in another part of the economy, and you certainly wouldn't get it in retail like at a Walmart or a Target store.
Can you explain, with the problems that Ford is citing, why it managed to post a profit in 2005?
So there are two reasons. It did well outside the United States on its worldwide automotive operations, and it also did incredibly well on its financial operations. The biggest problem for Ford is North America, and in fact, Ford said today that they don't expect to post a profit on automotive operations in North America until 2008. So there'll be another couple of years of losses for Ford.
And by the way, did Ford claim any responsibility for some of these North American losses? I mean, analysts have been telling them for years to switch from SUVs to more efficient cars.
Well, this is something that Bill Ford himself said today, was that they were basically basing their product plans on the market of the past, sort of business as usual, and now it's time to be innovative and go forward. But, you know, Ford has staked its claim to be an environmentally friendly company, and yet Toyota is the company that went out first and fastest with hybrid electric vehicles. So Ford, like General Motors, is playing catch-up in that area.
And by the way, these cuts announced today are also aimed at white-collar workers, but are they shouldering a fair share of the cuts?
Well, they're cutting about 4,000 salary jobs, which is about 10% of their total salaried workforce, and the number of officers at Ford will be cut by about 12%. But you have to look at companies like Toyota, Honda, and some of the leaner companies that have far less staff and far fewer executives. This is a big issue in Detroit, where you have dozens and dozens of vice presidents and you know, lots of workers, but the output is getting smaller and smaller. Ford used to have a quarter of the market, and that has fallen to about 16% in the United States.
Mickey Maynard is Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times. And Mickey, you've also been writing about Detroit, which has been getting all spiffed up, getting ready for the Super Bowl on February 5th. This has really got to dampen those spirits a little bit.
Well, actually, General Motors had already made a similar announcement to this about a month and a half ago or 2 months ago now. So the Super Bowl is coming. It'll be a momentary time to celebrate, to sort of say, look, Detroit is going to come back. I think the big question about that is it a one-week celebration and then the reality just comes barreling down on Detroit again?
Mickey Maynard of the New York Times, Detroit bureau chief, on today's announcement from Ford, a cut of upwards of 30,000 jobs and a closing of 14 plants. Mickey, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
With just 2 days to go now before Palestinians vote in their first parliamentary elections in a decade, polls show the militant group Hamas prepared to post big wins. Hamas is identified by the U.S. as a terrorist organization responsible for targeting and killing Israelis. It's also the biggest challenge to the ruling party Fatah, led by President Mahmoud Abbas. Fatah has been losing support despite millions of dollars in U.S. and European aid because many Palestinians see it as corrupt. To look ahead to Wednesday's elections, we're joined on the line by Matt Rees, contributing editor to Time magazine. He's based in Jerusalem. Matt, thanks so much for your time.
Good to be with you.
And set the stage for us. As we said, the first legislative election in the Palestinian territories in a decade, but also the first, including Hamas. So what's the feeling on the ground? Are people participating? Are they excited?
Well, people are excited in the sense that it does give them an opportunity to vote against the ruling Fatah party, which as you mentioned, has been seen as extremely corrupt. Hamas is setting itself up as the anti-Fatah, if you like. They're setting themselves up as a party of people who are qualified to run things, educated people, doctors and lawyers, as opposed to Fatah, which is these maneuvering party hacks with no real talent. And so they're also saying that we are the clean party, which is their reputation amongst Palestinians. The name of the party that they're actually running in the elections as the Hamas party is called Change and Reform. Mm-hmm. So that gives you an idea of how they're casting themselves.
How is Fatah countering that?
Well, Fatah really doesn't have very many achievements in 12 years of ruling in the West Bank and Gaza to throw up against Hamas. Hamas has this network of charitable institutions which they've run and funded, whereas the government institutions funded by billions of dollars in aid that have come in are actually very subpar. So Fatah is trying to cast itself as a party of struggle against the Israeli occupation. A year ago, when they had the presidential elections, the Fatah candidate ran as someone who could provide a good economic foundation for ordinary Palestinians. That's what they wanted, and they voted for him overwhelmingly. But now the divisions within Fatah are such that the Fatah leaders are trying to cater to the gunmen on the ground who really want to be seen as the heroic fighters. So all the posters that you see from Fatah tend to focus on guns and prisoners in jail in Israel rather than the economy.
This is funny. We read one poster slogan says, only the shoulders of the fighters can raise the torches of freedom. Vote for Fatah. And it's kind of a weird role reversal since Fatah has been, with President Abbas, you know, trying at least to walk gingerly towards peace and a two-state solution, whereas it's Hamas that funds the suicide bombers. So their campaigning is a little bit of a role reversal.
Well, the leadership of Fatah at the moment is in a terrible trouble because they have been unable to get rid of the old Yasser Arafat holdovers who are corrupt and extremely unpopular and don't bring any support from the street. So they're trying to cater to these gunmen on a local level who've built up these very violent fiefdoms over the course of the Intifada. And they're trying to draw them back inside the political system. At the moment, they really seem to be outside and ready to break the party up completely.
You know, we're going to talk more about Hamas, but that division within Fatah, how dangerous is that ultimately going to be?
Senior Palestinian Authority people, several of them, have told me in the last couple of weeks, they're extremely worried that there'd be some kind of assassination attempt either during the election or just before it, or in the weeks after it. they're worried that the gunman will say, look, the list of candidates that you have is made up of all these old corrupt leaders. We don't want the election to go ahead, so we'll try and assassinate someone, perhaps even the president himself, Mahmoud Abbas. If that doesn't happen before the election, the danger has not passed, because once the gunmen see who gets elected, if it's these old holdover leaders, maybe they'll decide to just go out and get rid of them themselves. If they can't get rid of them through democratic means, maybe they'll do it through violence.
Well, I hate to be so negative, but it does sound as if Fatah survives as a leader, it might not actually even be able to govern. But putting Fatah aside for a second, Hamas, we're going to be speaking more with a Palestinian American analyst in just a moment. But Mahmoud Abbas suggested last week he might resign if Hamas tries to block his peace plan, if they win, for instance, or get a number of seats. Hamas has said it doesn't recognize Israel's right to exist. So how can Abbas or Israel negotiate if a large part of parliament refuses to recognize Israel's right to exist at all? I mean, it seems as if either outcome could have pretty violent consequences on the other side.
It certainly could. But the thing to remember about Hamas is they view themselves as a gradualist organization. They're not trying to have some kind of Islamic revolution. What they believe in is a gradual move towards, ultimately, an Islamic state and Islamic Sharia law. So their leaders, in fact, one of them just today, has been talking about how it would be possible to have contact with Israel. Ultimately, they still want to destroy Israel, and that's still in their charter. But in the meantime, they could have contact because they recognize that they have to be pragmatic. And President Abbas, all the way along, has tried to bring Hamas into the political system. And I think he'll continue to do that even after these elections.
In the meantime, though, they're burying that message about Hamas in the sloganeering and the campaigning. Matt Reese, we have about a minute left. We've heard that there is a Hamas candidate, for instance, a woman who's been campaigning for the right of women to be suicide bombers. Is that true? Is that kind of language getting into the campaign?
There's a certain amount of that language that goes on, but there are, and of course there are women on the Hamas list as well, which is a new thing. But the Hamas campaign is very much about a straightforward Islamic message. Islam is the solution is their main campaign slogan. And that's what they're focusing on. It's going to be to ordinary Palestinians, perhaps talk about suicide bombers and so on, but there will be a very pragmatic approach both towards the parliament and the governing party and towards Israel.
Matt Reese, contributing editor to Time magazine. He's based in Jerusalem. He's also author of the book Cain's Field, Faith, Fratricide, and Fear in the Middle East. Matt, thanks so much as usual.
Always a pleasure.
And Matt mentioned the list. That's the slate of candidates. People are voting on Wednesday, not for individuals, but for parties. Well, we're going to find out more about the Hamas party. How did it come to be so popular? We'll speak with an analyst when we come back. Much more ahead, here and now. Polls Wednesday to elect a new parliament. This election marks the first time candidates representing the militant group Hamas will be on the ballot. To talk more about Hamas and explain its increasing popularity, we're joined by Professor Fuad Mughrabi. He's the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Tennessee in Chattanooga. He's also the founder of the Katan Center for Educational Research and Development in Ramallah. Welcome, Professor, and remind us, when was Hamas founded?
It emerged during the first Intifada. As it emerged, the Israelis actually encouraged its emergence. They saw it as a way of trying to counterbalance the PLO and the influence of the PLO in the occupied territories.
Now, remind us, this first Intifada was when?
88.
Mm-hmm. So it's a relatively young group.
Yes.
Can you explain its rise in popularity? It's organized with two wings, a social services wing and a militant branch.
Right.
How has each appealed to people?
Well, the most important aspect of Hamas's work really is its social services. They have an extensive network of social clinics, schools. They give aid to the poor. They fallen in the struggle against Israel and the occupation.
Now, when you say they give aid and comfort to those who have fallen, are these the families of suicide bombers?
Yes, suicide bombers, people who were killed by the Israelis, people who were in jail.
Do they back and pay for and train suicide bombers?
Well, I'm sure they do, yes.
Who pays for this, by the way? Who funds Hamas?
Well, my understanding is that the money comes from either local money that is raised or money that comes from different parts of the Arab world. Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, perhaps from individuals more so than from governments.
Tell us more about their appeal. Obviously, they're seen as a social service group.
There are two reasons for the appeal. As I mentioned, the first one is the fact that they provide assistance to a fairly large segment of the population that is marginalized. And this is, by the way, the same phenomenon that exists elsewhere in the Arab world. That is, the sectors of the society that are marginalized and ignored by the ruling governments and the ruling parties, the Islamic groups tend to respond to their needs. So that's one. And the second is the fact that they are perceived by the majority of the population as having led the struggle against the Israeli occupation.
Well, I was going to ask you, do people really embrace Hamas's extreme political views? In other words...
Not necessarily. I think that one has to differentiate between embracing their agenda, their political or ideological agenda, and actually endorsing their what they do. Mm-hmm. I think the two are not the same.
So they may not endorse the violence, but do...
No, they would endorse. I think there were times when the majority of the population endorsed their violence because they saw that somebody at least was acting against the Israelis.
Do Palestinians endorse Hamas's refusal to acknowledge Israel's right to exist?
Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. No. As I mentioned, they do endorse the fact that at least somebody is acting against the Israeli occupation. That doesn't necessarily mean that they would accept their political agenda or their ideological positions. For example, they would not necessarily endorse the fact that Hamas refuses to accept Israel's right to exist, or that Israel is a fact and has to be dealt with. Or they would not necessarily endorse the fact that Hamas or some of the religious groups are against singing in public or against having restaurants that serve alcohol or stuff like this. No. The majority of the population is fairly secular. And they don't necessarily see that as the ideal society to live in.
How much debate is there within Hamas about change?
When I was there, I could tell that there was a fairly vigorous debate among two generations of Hamas leadership, just like there is a debate among the generational differences within Fatah, for example. The younger people, who are much better educated, much more sophisticated, versus the older leadership. The younger leadership wants to be more practical, more pragmatic, and much more in tune with the public opinion of the Palestinian population, and much more realistic as to what can be achieved now and what should be achieved later.
Which one do you think will rule out? Because as we see Wednesday's election...
I think the younger generation will prevail. That's my guess.
Does that mean that they will, A, renounce violence, and B, accept the idea of two states?
They will accept the principle of working for an independent Palestinian state. That's my understanding. As to renouncing violence, I don't think that will happen. Because as long as the occupation continues, they will maintain the right to react violently if they have to.
When you say occupation, Hamas believes in the 1967 borders. In other words, believes that Israel should be out of both the West Bank and Gaza.
Exactly.
But will that be enough for the Hamas hardliners who don't think Israel should exist at all?
Deep within the psyche of every Palestinian is this kind of desire to see the Israelis disappear from the face of the earth. I mean, this is obvious historically the case. But people are not going to act on these deep-seated desires. They act based on pragmatic solutions. And also to suggest the same thing from the other side, deep in the psyche of every Israeli is the dream that the Palestinians would somehow disappear from the face of the earth. But they both sides have come to the point where they recognize that the other side is there and that it has to be dealt with. I think that's a fact. I see it as a fact, even including Hamas.
Professor Fuad Mughrabi, the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Tennessee in Chattanooga, also the founder of the Katan Center for Educational Research and Development in Ramallah. Professor, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, a question. Would you spend less on health care if you and not your employer had to pay more of it? We'll look at a radical vision of health care reform that's got the president's ear but has critics saying, oh yeah? Look at the Medicare prescription plan. This new plan will lead to the same confusion. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is a story about a largely unknown aspect of adoption. And again, this story may not be appropriate for younger or adopted children. USA Today reported that lawyers had told the newspaper that there was an underground network of families taking in children no longer wanted by their adoptive parents or too hard to handle. Much of the networking between parents takes place online. Reporter Wendy Koch wrote the story. Here's her description of how the network works.
There may be chat rooms help each other out of difficult situations. And it's really just, you know, parents sharing problems raising their children. But what will happen in some cases is that someone may say, well, I really just cannot handle this child anymore. And so then informally someone may email that person and say, well, I may know someone who can take this kid off your hands, essentially.
That's USA Today reporter Wendy Koch on what she called an underground network of families taking in children from other adoptive parents. Well, today we hear from an adoptive parent. Sharon Meyer is an adoptive mother of 30 in Florida and the founder of the Foundation for Large Families. One of her children is a Ukrainian child who was no longer wanted by her first adoptive parents. I began by asking Sharon if she was part of this network of families taking in children.
Wait, am I part of the underground network?
Well, you laugh. Why?
Because there is no underground network. This is more like media sensationalism, the way they use these words.
Well, what would you call it?
Adoption support groups. They've been around for probably hundreds of years, as long as adoption has been around.
But I don't think people realized that they were not just supporting each other, but they were literally taking children without agencies involved. And I think that's what's a little surprising for people.
Well, there is agencies involved. I don't understand where. There are many different forms of adoption. Everybody keeps saying the state does not know about these children. Well, they may not be state children. The state only places children for adoption who are in their care in the foster care system.
But let me ask you, wouldn't
you say that the state moves children from foster home to foster home? Are they an underground network?
Well, it's supposed to be, though, registered in a public way. And I guess I just want to ask, have you ever brought a child into your home just by meeting them online or another family offered the child to you?
I've had attorneys call me.
Mm-hmm.
I've had families call me. They're private adoptions.
I understand you adopted a Ukrainian girl through friends.
Yes, I have a child. Private adoption from Ukraine. She had autism.
And how did she come into your home?
I was called by an attorney.
Yeah. Are you at all worried about the concern that some may have that while it sounds as if you are a very upfront mother of 30 children taken in, how many children of the ones you have do have some disability?
Well, I've been doing this since 1980, so I have 15 left at home. Most of my children are grown and gone. It's
right.
Not like 30 all at once.
How many have been disabled?
I guess just about all of them have had some type of diagnosis, from severe brain damage to, you know, emotionally disturbed.
Yeah. And you said you got the call from the lawyer about this Ukrainian child who had autism. Do you feel that you're actually providing a service, taking children that other parents can't handle?
Well, through various adoption support groups, we may get the word out there. There is no place for these parents who adopt children from overseas. Now, there's one area that does need work, and I'll agree to that, and that's independent adoptions, where families who maybe they can't have children and they know nothing about children or raising children, they get a home study done just by a social worker. They approve their home. They can then go overseas to another country. And certain countries allow this, certain countries don't. They go in the orphanages. I want that one. The orphanage, then, they may lie. They don't reveal everything. It's not as upfront. And you may be bringing a child back that has a lot more problems than you know about.
It sounds as if you're saying, do you think that the real problem here is parents who are getting into adoption not really understanding what they're getting into?
Those who are independently going overseas. Now, when you adopt through the state and you have a state home study or a private agency home study or through an attorney that maybe does adoptions, they have classes. There are certain criteria that must be met.
Mm-hmm.
In these independent, you don't see too much of that.
Yeah. Do you worry? It sounds as if you are performing a tremendous service. Do you worry, though, that this idea of people meeting up in chat rooms and just saying, you know, I can't handle a child, and someone says, well, I'll take that child for you, do you worry that that opens up room for nefarious people, for people who aren't as well-intentioned, to grab children, and nobody has a record of it?
That goes on every day with people that don't have children for adoption. You let your kids out to play, and somebody picks them up, and, you know, you have molested children. But there are people that, you know, these papers, like when they're doing respite care, they're drawn up by attorneys.
This is respite care when a parent feels that they just need some help
need
for
some
up to
help.
30 days.
Yes, while they're deciding what they have to do or where they're going to go. Because some of these kids, they're just not ready to handle.
So are you saying that...
You could go to any court and file on your own in front of a judge for legal guardianship. You don't need an agency.
But I guess we're asking, for instance, when you brought the Ukrainian girl into your home, did you file with some court? Did you go to a judge?
No, I went through my adoption agency. I just called my adoption agency, and we got the paperwork started.
Yeah.
All of this has to go through the courts at some point or another. In order for the parent to relinquish or terminate their parental rights, it's done in court.
Yeah. One of the things, Sharon, that our listeners have found disturbing about this story is the sense that parents are, in essence, giving up adopted children. They can't handle them. They're not, as we heard, they're not what they expected. Maybe they're not smart enough. Do you worry that that sort of, you know, that casts a pall on adoption?
Well, no, not really. It's just, you have to think of it as a private adoption. Every day, women give birth to children. Whatever reason, they give children up. It's a private adoption. You can adopt an adult. Maybe people just don't know about these things, but they've always been legal.
Mm. And I guess one last thing I want to take away from this, Sharon, is you're saying that at some point, someone, whether it's a court or a lawyer...
Nobody sends a child into another family unless they have a home study. I have never seen any parent that has taken a child because they know about the process.
Even if they meet online in a chat room and they say, take my child...
They usually spend a lot of time meeting the family first. It's not like just people coming to your door and here, take. Someone somewhere along the line knows, yes.
Yeah.
What we need more of is support for these families that are bringing children in. There is nothing set up out there for them to learn how to take care of these children so they don't have to place them for adoption. We need a better mental health care system.
Sharon Meyer, an adoptive mother of 30 children in Florida. She's also founder of the Foundation for Large Families, talking to us about people meeting people online and swapping adopted children. Still to come, the Fisher Poet. You're listening to Here and Now. An American icon is having an extreme makeover. Wonder Bread, that spongy loaf in the red, white, and blue bag that's been the delivery system for millions of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches since the company first debuted 80 years ago, is launching three new whole wheat versions today. The move is part of a plan to breathe some life back into Wonder Bread's baker, Interstate Bakeries, which also makes Twinkies, and has been struggling as more Americans try to avoid highly processed food in their diets. The company filed for bankruptcy in 2004 and closed several bakeries last year. So Stan Osman, Vice President of Marketing for Interstate Bakeries, joins us from the company's headquarters in Kansas City, Missouri. And I'm wondering, Stan, these probably do have to be tough times for the icon of processed food. I imagine there was a time when homemakers in particular were thrilled with this thing that they didn't have to spend hours baking.
Oh, well, there absolutely was, and it goes all the way back to the beginning. But, you know, Robin, Wonder has always been committed to providing nutritious options for consumers.
No, Stan.
It's true.
It's Wonder Bread we're talking about.
I know it is, but, you know, we've been building strong bodies for a long time. In fact, Wonder was one of the first breads to enrich white bread with vitamins and minerals.
Okay. Well, and Wonder Bread has also, you know, proudly, defiantly, shall we say, had absolutely no fiber. How much does the new whole wheat have? Give us some nutritional breakdown of the new bread.
Wonder white bread fans, 100% whole grain, has 2 grams of fiber in each slice, or 4 grams in a sandwich. Whole grain white has 4 grams in a sandwich, and Wonder Kids has 4 grams in a sandwich. The 100% whole grain, the Wonder white bread fans, is the first bread that was designed especially, specifically, to taste more like white bread.
Well, yeah, can you explain that for us? Because we do understand that, in fact, you may not even be able to tell that this has whole wheat in it.
Wonder made with whole grain white and white bread fans are made with white whole wheat flour instead of the red wheat flour, which is used in traditional wheat breads. White whole grain flour has the exact same nutritional value as red wheat flour, but it provides a softer texture and a more mild flavor, which is more similar to that of white bread.
Well, the taste part, for that, we have sent Here Now intern Angela Kim to the Shaw supermarket on Commonwealth Avenue here in Boston. She slugged through the snow that we're having to get us some new whole wheat Wonder Bread. Angela, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, I want you to take a piece of the bread there. And which loaf have you got? You've got a couple there.
I do. I actually have the whole grain white bread and also the white bread 100 whole grain as well.
Now, by the way, do they look like white bread still?
You know, the whole grain white one does. It's white. It just looks like a regular loaf of bread. The other one just looks like a wheat bread.
Well, actually, could you take each and give a bite and tell us what you think?
I'm taking the whole grain white one, and it's a little bit chewier than the regular white bread that I'm used to.
You have had Wonder Bread then?
Yes, I have. Grew up on the stuff. And then the other one, the 100% whole grain, it's a little brown, and it actually tastes similar to the one I just had, and the consistency is also the same, chewy.
So, Stan, it seems as if perhaps kids might not even know they're getting something a little healthier.
Well, you know, Robin, that's exactly right. I think kids won't know. They'll just enjoy it. They'll enjoy the safe softness, the mild taste, the squishiness.
Ah, Angela, I have to ask, speaking of the squishiness, can you wad a piece up into a tight little ball, much like the former Wonder Bread?
I'm trying to do it right now, and yes, you definitely can.
Ah.
So we count on that.
Now, can you throw it? No, you're not supposed to. can you pop it in your mouth and eat one all at once when you've wadded it up?
I think it tastes similar to just the regular Wonder Bread when you do that.
As wadded up. Well, Stan, you've passed the taste test.
Well, and I'm glad to hear that.
And by the way, Stan, do you eat your Wonder Bread, you know, wadded up in a little ball?
I have been known to do that, yes.
Mm-hmm. Dunked in milk, it's particularly good.
Oh, I'm glad to hear we have a connoisseur with us.
Stan Osman, Vice President of Marketing for Interstate Bakeries. He spoke to us from the company's headquarters in Kansas City, Missouri, about the new whole wheat versions of Wonder Bread. Angela Kim, ace Here and Now intern and researcher, spoke to us from Shaw's Supermarket in Boston. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now. Mm-hmm. some fishermen write poetry. But first, some news we're following. Officials in Canada are announcing that a cow from a farm in Alberta has tested positive for mad cow disease. Canada's chief veterinary officer, Brian Evans, said today that the brain-wasting disease was found in an animal that was approximately 6 years old, but he said none of the infected animal was used to make animal feed products. The U.S. reopened its border to Canadian cattle back in July. It was closed after Canada reported its first case of mad cow disease in 2003. The commercial fishing trade has hit troubled waters on the Pacific Northwest coast. Fish harvests are down, competition and regulations are up, and the independent fisherman is a dwindling breed. Still, few professions are as romanticized. The lone fisherman or woman chugging out to sea at dawn, wind-hewn faces bracing against the elements and the odds, and oh, the tragedy of souls lost at sea. For a small Oregon town, romance meets reality at the annual Fisher Poets Conference. This year marks the eighth gathering of full-time fishermen and part-time poets. Producer Elizabeth Wynn Johnson jumped on deck to hear more.
I'll see if I can get the old girl running.
For almost half a century, Dave Densmore has earned his living on the water, up and down the coasts of Oregon, Washington, and Alaska, fishing tuna and trolling for salmon.
We're kind of a throwback. Commercial fishermen are kind of the last of something that used to be pretty common. And it's in a lot of ways, it's kind of sad. But I don't mind being the last as long as I'm still am.
Densmore's got a nickname, Dangerous Dave. And he looks the part, dark shoulder-length hair and wild, wiry eyebrows, so long they cast shadows over his mismatched eyes, one green, one blue. But looks can be deceiving. Late at night, alone on the water, he dials up a quiet channel on the VHF radio and reads for hours, while far-flung crabbers and gillnetters listen in.
Yeah, here's one for you guys. Working offshore there tonight. Call it radio chatter. I was running up the coast through a long, dark, rainy night, drinking coffee and scanning the V, giving sleep a solid fight. Dialed up a couple fellows talking, one an old-timer by the sound. They're talking of all the changes. Both sounded pretty down.
Full-time fisherman, part-time poet, is how Densmore describes himself. If he stops after just a few poems, guys radio back and ask him to keep reading.
Okay. But the old-timer held my attention. He expressed my thoughts without fail. I swear it sounded like that old man must have read my mail. In about the saddest voice I've ever heard, he said, I'm proud of my life and what I've done, but it's changing so fast now. Wouldn't want it for my son.
Densmore's written over 200 poems. He keeps them in an aging binder held together with duct tape. He says he catches poems rather than creating them, usually at night, when he's alone in the wheelhouse, staring at a row of windows that look out to nothing but darkness.
The more you look at them, the more they just kind of seem like a blank blackboard, and all kinds of ideas come springing out of them at you. I've made more than one run from the stern to the galley to get a piece of paper and a pencil to write something down before I forget it.
His poem, Hands, was inspired by looking down at his own cold, thick fingers.
As I sat there, I got to thinking about all the things that they'd done, from pulling nets and crab pots to holding my baby son. From wrenching on greasy engines to dressing out a deer, from clenching fists of anger to holding my lover near. They sure have run the gauntlet, really been through the mill. It's a wonder that they work at all, or that I have them still. These hands are beat, scarred, and battered, not the most graceful ones you'll see. But hell, I ain't no pitcher, so I guess they fit the rest of me.
There are a lot more closet poets in the fishing industry than you might imagine.
John Van Amerongen is editor of the Seattle-based Alaska Fisherman's Journal.
I think just the fact that people are out there by themselves experiencing nature in its rawest form and also dealing with their emotions in their rawest form leads them to somehow pick up a pen and write on the galley table. I get poetry that's written on the backs of envelopes, on the backs of fish tickets. I got one on the back of a canned salmon label.
Some of the best comes from former commercial fisherman Gino Leach. He's taking a break from life on the water. He owns a couple of seafood restaurants in Chinook, Washington, where it's warm and dry beside a crackling fire on misty North Coast days.
Well, I don't miss the bar crossings and back-breaking toil, the ice forks and shovels and saltwater boils, or diesel-fouled forecastles with iron and board bunks, the stink, the sweat, the gurian funk. I don't miss the buck, the bang and the roll, kidney-punching Norwesters and nut-numbing cold.
Gino Leach doesn't harbor romantic notions about seafaring life. Fishers will tell you the sun shines brighter and the beer tastes better after a long, hard trip. Leach says the best thing about fishing is when you stop.
Well, sometimes at night in a tea cozy warm bed, I think of the years that I stood on my head, dragging, crabbing, and albacore jigging. Yeah, I miss a fish, but I don't miss a fishing.
Leach hasn't dropped anchor for good. He says something always seems to call him back.
I think I'd rather have stories to tell than a bank account. You know, I mean, when you die, I think the winner's the guy that has the most stories, you know.
Falling prices, industry consolidation, and the growth of fish farming are chipping away at the role of the commercial fisherman. Every February, fisher poets converge on the coastal town of Astoria to share stories about their disappearing way of life. Some of it is set to music. John Van Amerongen wrote this song about Dangerous Dave Densmore. It's called Hell on Fish.
He don't need no radar, he don't need no scope, he don't need no charge, you know he ain't no dope. He's got his mojo working, don't need no boat, just a spool of nylon leader and a box full of hooks. He's wearing black leather rain gear, got an earring and a tattoo too. Yes, he's hell on fish and he'll be cleaning out a drag near you. You know he's hell on fish and he'll be cleaning out a drag near you.
The Fisher Poets Gathering has become a popular event on the Oregon tourist calendar. Some fishermen cringe at the mere mention of the words tourist attraction, but the audience is growing each year. And Gino Leach says he has a pretty good idea of why they come.
You know, people are just, they're dying for something real. They can almost, you know, eat it like a steak, you know, put it in a to-go box and take it home. You know, I think people kind of hunger for that.
I'm Elizabeth Wynn Johnson in Astoria.
We were drinking beer, tossing darts one night at the Elbow Room. I was fresh out of school, working on the beach from midnight till the afternoon. My back was strong and my mind was weak, so it seemed all right to me.
For more on the annual Fisher Poets Convention in Clatsop County, Oregon, visit our website, here-now.org.
Where you scoop the ocean's riches, just pull them aboard for free. Asked if I could, sure as hell I would take a job on the Bering Sea. Now Jake was a grizzly engineer on the Crabber Arctic Cross. For a round or two he could get me aboard, cause he knew the old deck boss. When I quit my job at the Westward plant, I was giddy, I was free. Though I didn't have much, I was leaving Dutch for a job on the Bering Sea. Where you scoop the ocean's riches, just pull them aboard for free. He asked if I could, and I said I would take a job on the Bering Sea.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and